It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. A suicide bomber was killed, 2 security guards were wounded in a blast outside the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia's second largest city of Jeddah earlier today. No one has claimed responsibility so far, but the Islamic State has carried out a series of bombings and shooting attacks in Saudi Arabia since late 2014. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for a suicide truck bombing in a busy shopping area, the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, that happened early Sunday, killing nearly 120, wounding about 200. It was the most deadly attack in the Iraqi capital this year. Georgetown University visiting professor R. Nicholas Palerino says, as long as the Islamic State holds key territory, such attacks will never go away.
They have what's called these rat lines from these different safe haven areas where they can get into large cities like Baghdad and destroy things and kill people. As long as you have those safe havens where the Islamic State, then they're able to project their destruction to other areas, not only in the region, but also to Europe, and hopefully never to the United States, but you never know what's going to happen.
U.S. condemned Sunday's attack, including a second assault that left at least 5 dead. The blast occurred a little more than a week after Iraqi forces ousted IS militants from the city of Fallujah. In Libya, at least 2 people were killed, several others wounded in a car bombing in the eastern city of Benghazi. Early Sunday blasts apparently targeted a passing convoy carrying a senior police official. 2 dead were apparently traffic police. Benghazi has been the scene of clashes between Islamists and forces loyal to the eastern administration. This is VOA News. Bangladesh is observing the second day of mourning after a group of 7 Islamist militants killed 20 hostages and 2 police officers during an 11-hour siege at an upscale restaurant in Dhaka. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, but that has not been confirmed, and government officials deny IS involvement. Lorianne Walsh Emdad is principal of the American Standard School in Dhaka. She lives a block from where the restaurant was attacked. She tells VOA Islamic militants have been active in Bangladesh in recent times.
We've had a few incidents beginning from the fall of last year until now. We've been having incidents of Hindus being killed, LGBT activists being killed, bloggers being killed, and all of them are usually then perpetrated by Islamic militants.
Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, or AQIS, has claimed responsibility for many of those attacks. The U.S. just declared that group a foreign terrorist organization. Elie Wiesel, who survived the Nazi death camps during World War II to become a world-renowned author and Nobel Peace Prize winner, has died at the age of 87. Wiesel won the 1986 Nobel Peace Prize for speaking out against war and discrimination, keeping memories of the Holocaust alive, and also the suppression of human rights. He spoke at the 1993 dedication of the Holocaust Museum here in Washington about the purpose of those doing what he does.
We teach by example. We live as examples. If we could reduce the hate in one person, I think that in itself would create a difference for the whole world. I believe in that whatever we do leaves a trace somewhere.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu mourned Wiesel by saying he gave expression to the victory of the human spirit over cruelty and evil. President Obama called Wiesel a dear friend who was one of the great moral voices of our time. Today is America's 240th birthday. It's known as Independence Day. Americans just about everywhere taking part in celebrations with fireworks displays like the one later today here in Washington. In Philadelphia, where the Founding Fathers approved the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the National Birthday Party runs all day. It's an opportunity for people to celebrate those who serve in this country, the police, the firefighters, emergency medical crew, as well as the 1.3 million members of the U.S. Armed Services.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Monday, July the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The Niger Delta Avengers, a militant group that has been carrying out attacks on Nigerian oil facilities in the past few months, claimed responsibility on Sunday for five new attacks in the southern energy hub since Friday. And the Somali government says that it plans what it calls a massive military operation against Al-Shabaab after Ramadan.
These two regions are very significant. They are called Juba region, it's lower Juba region and middle Juba region, specifically because this is Al-Shabaab's heartland.
VOA Somali Services' Harun Maruf, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni will meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today to commemorate the Israeli raid on Entebbe 40 years ago. And President Joseph Kabila is due to step down as head of state of the Democratic Republic of Congo in December, but observers say that based on statements coming from DRC officials, the elections are likely to be delayed.
If they get away with prolonging the rain, if the people remain, generally speaking, quiet, then I think they're going to try it. I'm not saying that they're going to succeed, but I think they're going to try it.
Hans Hobeck is a senior Congo analyst at the International Crisis Group. Those stories, plus Marco Wuma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The Somali government announced that it plans to launch what it calls a massive military operations against Al-Shabaab in the areas of Lower Juba and Middle Juba. This past Friday, in a speech marking Somalia's 56th independence, the Somali president Hassan Sheikh Mohamed called on the militant group to end what he called their suicidal mission and stop their brutal attacks. Harun Maruf is a reporter with VOA Somali Service covering global conflict and Al-Shabaab in particular. He tells me that the two areas mentioned by the Somali president's office are known to be Al-Shabaab's heartland or spiritual home.
Yeah, it was very unusual for the president's office to announce what they called massive military operation against Al-Shabaab. Very soon, they did not specify exactly when they will launch. But according to military sources, they are looking forward to attacking Al-Shabaab after the Ramadan.
Okay.
That could take in days or weeks, and they're going to target specifically two key regions in southern Somalia, lower Juba region and middle Juba region.
Okay, so they're going to attack lower Juba region and the middle Juba regions. Is there significance to this location strategically for Al-Shabaab or even for the government for that matter?
These two regions are very significant. They are called Juba region, it's lower Juba region and middle Juba region, specifically because this is Al-Shabaab's heartland. This is Al-Shabaab's spiritual home, if you call it. This is where Somali militant organizations were formed. This is where they go when they lose a battle. This is where they regroup. They have easy access to forest. Probably you can find 400-kilometer forest, easy access to water, livestock, and food. And it will take very strong army to penetrate and destroy their bases.
Okay. And what do you make of the timing of this announcement? This couple of days, for example, Uganda has announced that they might be withdrawing, or they will be withdrawing at the end of next year, their troops from AMISOM, and that generally they set a certain wariness among AMISOM troops and AMISOM contributing countries that at this point the government of Somalia should be able to handle their security by themselves. What do you make of this timing in relation to some of these factors?
The timing is significant as well, and there are many aspects to this announcement, I believe. Number one, the Somali government and AMISOM have been on the back foot for some months. Al-Shabaab has been carrying out heavy attacks, and they wanted to push back. They want to push back before the elections take place in August and in September. That is very significant for them to show that they can control and they can the security will be in their hands. Number two, as you said, Uganda said it's going to withdraw. The Somali government has to show that it is army who have been trained in neighboring countries as well as by the United States. can really take and launch some significant attacks on Al-Shabaab. And the government in particular said the Somali army will be taking the lead in this attack. So that's very significant. The United States government trained about 500 commando units. In the past few months, they have been carrying out special operations. In one operation, the Somali army were very successful. They killed the mastermind of Garissa University attack. And they want to show primarily that Somali army really can play a big part in the attack. Not necessarily they cannot, they might not still be able to hold large areas because they don't have the capacity, but they can lead a fight and carry out an offensive against Al-Shabaab.
Based on your reporting, do you feel that Al-Shabaab has been more active in the last year in terms of targeting government locations and civilian populations?
Within the last year, Al-Shabaab has been very strategic with its attacks. They have carried out these carefully planned heavy attacks on military bases. So far, they have been very successful in overrunning key military bases, whether they were run by AMISOM or Somali military. And so far this year, we're into 6 months in this year, they have already carried out five key attacks. Two main hotels in Mogadishu and three major attacks on military installations and another attack on Puntland. Two of their attacks have not ended well for them. They had some setbacks, in particular the attack on Helgen last month. That's the attack on Ethiopian military base in Somalia. They have lost quite a number of men. Also, they have lost a quite number of men in the attack on Puntland, but the attack was very symbolic. It was very strategic. But one key consistent attack that we have seen in the last few months, in particular this year, is Al-Shabaab's determination to neutralize, to cripple AMISOM logistical supplies. They have been carrying out regular improvised explosive devices, landmines targeting AMISOM vehicles. And I think what they're trying to do is to isolate forward military bases, and cripple the logistical supplies. And they wanted to force AMISOM and the government to move back, to go to main military positions, and give Al-Shabaab more space to maneuver and operate.
VOA's Somali service reporter Haroon Maruf. And Puntland President Abdiwell Mohamed Ali says that he's fully engaged in the battle against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. In fact, he recently vowed that Al-Shabaab prisoners could be executed in revenge for the targeted killings against his people. During his recent visit to Washington, D.C., President Ali spoke to VOA's Peter Cloti.
My main focus for coming here was to engage the Puntland diaspora, Somali diaspora in the United States of America and also in Canada, Northern America.
Looking at Puntland, what is the relevance of Puntland in the fight against terrorism, particularly Al-Shabaab?
You know, Puntland is one third of the Somali territory and almost one third of the Somali population. It's strategically located, bordering both the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. We are bordering Yemen, which is now it's a huge problem, you know, the issue of Yemen. And the Indian Ocean. So we are fighting against piracy, we are fighting against illegal migration, we are fighting against Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization who was wreaking havoc in that part of the world. It's a global phenomenon. It's not Somali problem. It's not a regional problem. Actually, it's a huge international problem. So Puntland is very important. And we are looking the international community, our international partners, to help us, all these menace, all these non-state actors who are creating problems for peace and stability in the region and also for peace and stability in worldwide.
How do you cooperate with the government in Mogadishu in this regard to address the problem of insecurity, particularly Al-Shabaab?
Of course, this is a common enemy, so therefore we should have a common strategy. And we are working together with the federal government, and we want to face this as a united Somalia. This enemy doesn't care whether you are from the south or from the east or from the west or the, from the north. It's un-Islamic. It's given a bad name to Islam. It's given a bad name to our culture and religion. And so we have to be united against it. So we have no choice but to work together.
So looking forward, what are the prospects of peace returning to Somalia as a whole?
I'm very optimistic about the future of Somalia. You know, the Somali society are very strong, very vibrant, very resilient. And this is a long war. But at the same time, if you look where we came from, in a difficult civil war, to warlordism, to Islamic Courts Union, to traditional federal governments, and now we have a full governance in Somalia. So if you look where we came from, where we are today, it's an oceans apart. But still, we have more to do. We have to liberate the country from the yoke of al-Shabaab. We have to stabilize the country. We have to build all the regional administrations so all the Somalis have semblance of governance everywhere in Somalia. And then to govern the country democratically where everybody has a vote and a voice. Okay? This is the ultimate dream of Somalia. We can take this country forward.
That was Puntland President Abdiwell Mohamed Ali. He spoke with Peter Clotty right here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. President Joseph Kabila is due to step down as head of state of the Democratic Republic of Congo in December, but it is looking increasingly likely that this year's elections will be delayed. Statements by the president and the lead opposition figure now in exile underscore the uncertainty of the Central African nation's political future and the potential flashpoints ahead. William Close has more for VOA from Kinshasa.
President Joseph Kabila's Independence Day speech was pre-recorded, as usual. Kabila is a famously reluctant public speaker, but his words were anything but timid. The defiant head of state summoned the Congolese people to resist what he called untimely and unlawful foreign interference. He repeatedly praised his security services. His comments are seen as a direct response to targeted sanctions imposed by the US government on one of Kabila's most senior police chiefs on June 23rd. The US government, as well as members of Congress, have accused the Kabila government of deliberately delaying elections that should take place in November and of cracking down on the opposition and civil society. Further sanctions may be forthcoming. This was supposed to be Kabila's final Independence Day as president. The nation's constitution limits him to 2 terms in office, but it is looking unlikely the polls will be held this year. The Electoral Commission says it needs more than a year to prepare the voter rolls, and the Constitutional Court ruled in May that Kabila can stay in power until the election is held. In his speech, the president insisted voter registration will start imminently and that nothing can stop the election from happening. But in recent weeks, senior officials close to Kabila have spoken publicly of holding a constitutional referendum first. If the people of Congo want more Kabila, they ask, why should they be denied? Hans Hobeck is a senior Congo analyst at the International Crisis Group.
At the moment, the voter registration will reach its end. I'm sure this will become a concrete proposal. Yeah. If they get away with prolonging the rain, if the people remain, generally speaking, quiet, then I think they're going to try it. I'm not saying that they're going to succeed, but I think they're going to try it.
And there is recent precedent. The leaders of two of the DRC's neighbors, Congo-Brazzaville and Rwanda, have successfully removed term limits through referendums and won fresh terms in office in the past year. For more than a year, Kabila has invited the opposition to participate in a political dialogue. Edem Kodjo, a former Togolese prime minister, is facilitating the efforts on behalf of the African Union. Most influential opposition leaders remain publicly hostile to Kabila's offer. They dismissed the dialogue as a trap and have begun to ask for US involvement on the facilitation panel. But qualified support can be found. Juvenal Manubu is a parliamentarian from one of the largest opposition parties. He told VOA that a dialogue acceptable to all sides is the country's last chance and must provide clear answers to 2 essential questions. On what date shall the presidential election take place? And who shall lead the DRC once Kabila's elected mandate expires on December 19th? For Munubu, if these questions can be answered, the main problems disappear and the election need not take place in 2016. More time could work in the opposition's favour. At present, there is no obvious opposition presidential candidate, and the separate coalitions are still trying to form a united front. Moise Katumbi points to the size of the fight on their hands. As yet, the only politician to declare his intention to contest the presidential election, Katumbi has left the DRC in May. He was subject to two sets of legal charges, one of them over the alleged hiring of mercenaries. In June, he was sentenced in absentia to 3 years in prison. Returning home to campaign is currently out of the question. Katumbi issued his own Independence Day statement. He said Kabila must leave power this year. He also condemned the charges against him as a crude means of preventing his candidature. The government has brushed it off, calling Katumbi's statement a pathetic diatribe. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The Niger Delta Avengers, a militant group that has been carrying out attacks on Nigerian oil facilities in the past few months, claimed responsibility on Sunday for five new attacks in the southern energy hub. The group had previously not laid claim to any attacks in the Niger Delta. Nigeria's Petroleum Ministry said in late June that a month-long truce had been agreed with militants, but the Avengers said they did not remember agreeing to a ceasefire. Attacks in the Niger Delta have pushed Nigerian crude production to 30-year lows. In messages posted on Twitter in the early hours of Sunday, the Avengers said they had attacked a pipeline connected to the Wari refinery operated by NNPC on Friday night. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni will meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today to commemorate the Israeli raid on Entebbe 40 years ago. According to the government, plans for the occasion do not include arrangements to honor on-duty soldiers the Israeli commandos killed in 1976 during the raid. VOA's Peter Clotis spoke to Ambassador James Mugume, the permanent secretary at the Ugandan Foreign Ministry.
The commemoration marking the 40th anniversary of Operation Jonathan took place 40 years ago during the raid on Entebbe, which many people have seen in the movie. After that, the Prime Minister will meet a number of heads of state here, and then we have a bilateral visit as well. We discuss areas of cooperation with Israel.
I was reading some dailies in the Ugandan newspapers, and they're saying during the raid, some Ugandans were killed who were fighting to protect the territorial integrity of Uganda. So it should not be celebrated on Monday, as some people are doing. Diplomatically, how is that possible if the Israeli Prime Minister is visiting and holding discussions, bilateral discussions at that, with President Yoweri Museveni and the government?
It's not a celebration. This is a memorial. A memorial marking the 40th anniversary of that. As you know, memorials are for different things. So I think there's a misunderstanding that it's a celebration. A memorial. And it's an event that took place in the circumstances where there had been hijacking, but also recognized and security council did take note about the sovereignty of state. But this is a commemoration. It's not a celebration.
Ambassador James Mugume is the permanent secretary at the Ugandan Foreign Ministry. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. The U.S. State Department's annual report on trafficking in persons said Mauritania does not fully comply with minimum standards for eliminating the practice and is not making, quote, significant efforts, end quote, to do so. From Nouakchott, Ahmed Musa reports on a family held captive for more than 30 years after Mauritania formally outlawed slavery. This report is narrated by VOA's Horn of Africa reporter Salem Solomon.
Fatma and her family were forced to work without pay or proper medical care, a practice that goes back centuries in Mauritania, where the darker-skinned Heritane ethnic group has been discriminated against by lighter-skinned white Moors. My masters deprived me of everything. They would not allow me to get treatment when I fell ill. They wouldn't allow my children and me to become educated. My children and I are uneducated, and we don't even know how to pray. I only worked for free, and all they gave me was a veil annually to cover myself.
Nonprofit groups working to end slavery say that when they bring cases like Fatma's to the attention of authorities, government response is often swift.
When we learned through our agents that there was a family under the yoke of slavery, we immediately contacted the governor of the region where the family lives. The governor gave instructions to gendarmes to investigate immediately. The gendarmes arrested the slave master and the family, and they have brought them to the prosecutor to complete the legal procedure.
Mauritania's parliament last year adopted a law recognizing slavery as a crime against humanity, emphasizing both progress and due process, says the minister of the Commission of Human Rights.
There was the creation of many specialized courts to fight remnants of slavery. These courts were not installed only in Nouakchott, but around the country as well, in order to allow a better proximity of jurisdiction for litigants.
Anti-slavery activists say the courts are not doing enough to enforce existing laws. The U.S. State Department report says authorities have failed to establish procedures to identify victims. Salem Solomon for Ahmed Musa, VOA News.
Meanwhile, authorities in Mauritania arrested 9 anti-slavery activists on Sunday, accusing them of starting a riot in which several police officers were injured. A spokesman for the anti-abolitionist group said that the arrests are an attempt to use the riot in the capital Nouakchott to discredit the Initiative for the Resurgence of the Abolitionist Movement, IRA. The riot started when police moved squatters from the Haritin ethnic group, many of them former slaves, from an area they have occupied for decades. Slavery is a crime against humanity in Mauritania, but the practice is still believed to affect between 4% and 20% of the population. Anti-slavery activists are frequently at odds with the government. And now, time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Woma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Kenya women's football team Harambee Starlets outwitted their visiting Ugandan opposite numbers, Uganda Falcons 4-0, in a friendly match played in Kisumu, Western Kenya on Sunday. The Harambee Starlets are gearing up for their maiden appearance in the Africa Women's Cup of Nations in Cameroon in November. Meanwhile, Morocco dismissed Mauritania 2-0 as Botswana edged Namibia 2-1 in Africa Under-17 Championship qualifiers on Sunday. Earlier on Saturday, Tanzania outclassed Seychelles 6-0 as Algeria outplayed Libya 2-1. On Friday. In rugby news, defending champions Namibia beat hosts Uganda 41-30 in the opening match at the Africa Rugby Division 1A Championship in Kampala on Saturday. The tournament, which is a round-robin contest that also features Kenya and Zimbabwe, is Africa's premier 15-a-side rugby contest where the winner is crowned African Cup champions. In athletics, the world junior 800-meter champion Alfred Kipketer clocked 1 minute and 43.73 seconds to triumph in the two-lap race at the Kenya Olympic trial in Eldoret, Western Kenya on Saturday. Ferguson Rotich was runner-up ahead of world record holder and Olympic champion David Rudisha. The world champion Asbel Kiprop prevailed in men's 1500 meters ahead of Elijah Manangoi and Ronald Quemoy, while Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon carried the day in the women's 1500 meters with Nancy Chepkwemoy second ahead of Viola Lagat. Maureen Nyairera won the women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 58.27 seconds. In a spirited sprint for the finish line, Brimin Kipruto emerged winner in men's 3,000 meter steeplechase. Consensus Kipruto was second ahead of Olympic and world champion Ezekiel Kemboi, while world champion Hyvin Kieng won the women's 3,000 meter steeplechase with Beatrice Chepkoech and Lydia Rotich following her across the finish line. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Eteguini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of Daybreak Africa producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Next on Let's Talk. Jeans are a very popular part of our casual dressing around the world. Do you have a pair or more? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing jeans. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.